when I say learn to meditate, it's that to what extent when things are challenging, can you actually keep perspective and objectivity around what's going on?
And that was Nico Plowman, Vedic meditation teacher and co-founder of Insight Timer. And you're listening to the Influence Unlocked podcast. Welcome to season 4 of the Influence Unlocked podcast. And I'm your host, Samantha Dyback, the founder and CEO of the PR Hub. This is a podcast dedicated to taking you behind the scenes of what it takes to really grow a brand, get an insight into the world of public relations, and show you how to harness your own power of influence. Whether you're looking to kickstart your own personal brand, want to learn more about what goes into building a great business, develop your leadership skills, or simply find inspiration for your own success, then you're in the right place. Join me in conversation with some of Australia's brightest entrepreneurs, industry leaders and change makers as we go beyond the news headlines and highlight reels to explore the highs and lows of their journeys and understand what makes them tick. Get ready to unlock your influence. Today, I thought it would be great to bring on the podcast one of our clients at the PR Hub, not only because he is a client, but because he has a rich and uniquely interesting story of how he came to be where he is today, perfect for this podcast. In years gone by, Nico Plowman has been described as a high-flying, hard-living entrepreneur heading down a path of mental, emotional, and physical destruction. Despite the descriptor, Nico has achieved some extraordinary success and through his own personal journey of discovery has developed a deeper purpose in life that has not only enhanced his life, but he's also now using that experience to help others enhance theirs. From an early age, Nico found himself attracted to the bright lights of business and paved a way to work with some amazing international organizations like ESPN and was the co-founder of a multi-million dollar tech software company in his 30s. Nico found himself traveling to and living in some of the coolest places in the world, working in sports, entertainment, and business. Despite the riches, the glitz, the glamour, the fast-paced and high-flying lifestyle became unsustainable. And at 40, Nico was introduced by a friend to Vedic meditation. What followed was an extraordinary life transformation, including he and his brother Christopher co-founding global meditation app Insight Timer, and Nico committing to doing life and business consciously. A father to three daughters, Nico is now practicing and teaching his Vedic meditation technique to others around the world. And it is a delight to have him here in the studio today with me. Welcome, Nico, to the Influence Unlocked.
Thank you for having me. Fantastic to be here.
It's great to have a client. I haven't had a client in studio for a little while. Obviously know a little bit about your story, and it's really why I wanted you to do this podcast, because you've got so much to share. And I can't wait to get into it. I have to give a shout out also to Alex from our team at the PR Hub, who is here today, who works closely with Nico on a day-to-day basis, not feeling the pressure at all to get any of these key messages right. Let's get into it. Nico, tell me, what is your one word for the day and why?
One word for the day, what a great question. I'm content today. Contentment. I've had a good day. I've spent some time with Alex today over in Balmoral Beach where I live. She's getting showcased today. You know, my morning always starts quite well. I'm a meditator. I'm fortunate to live in a beautiful part of Sydney. I get up in the morning, I do some various things that are sort of meditation related, and then I jumped in the ocean and had a swim. I spoke to a daughter of mine who's overseas. I spoke to another daughter of mine who was elsewhere in Sydney. And then I just got to get organised. I'm going away for the weekend up to Byron Bay for a few days. So I've just had a really easy day. It's a beautiful day here in Sydney. And so, I don't know, it's nice that when you can sit around on a Friday and just sort of reflect on the fact that things are all in the right place and things are reasonably easy. Not that that's always the way. Just today is a day like that. Yeah.
It's nice to have that relaxing, calming flow to start the podcast. It feels really good. And I want to talk a little bit more about what your day does look like these days. But let's go back to when you were 15 years old. So if you can imagine catching up with 15-year-old Nico today for coffee, would he be surprised at where you are?
So it's an interesting one to think about that age. And I know it was a time in my life where I think I was probably looking to fulfill maybe what I thought were the expectations of parents and peer group and all sorts of things. And around about that point in my life, if I reflect back on that, it was probably getting pretty hard to maybe keep up with all that. And if I was to look at things on the edges of that, which was academically and other things. I was probably starting just to step back a bit. Probably got my first B. I was a pretty high-achieving high-achieving kid. And back then, I would have felt that possibly the view of what was to come was very much what other people had, you know, wanted of me. Particularly, I think we grew up in certain ways and certain environments and socially and in certain families. And there's almost a path that is set that, you know, you would leave school and go to university and become a banker or a lawyer or any of those sorts of things that kind of seem to aggregate in the place. So it's a hard one to suggest that. Would I have thought that I would have been a meditation teacher? There is absolutely no way. And it wasn't on the list. It wasn't part of it. It wasn't something, if you think about it, that's now 35 years ago. People weren't even really talking about it, not in the mainstream anyway. Maybe there were a few people off doing their things. But the idea that, hey, you'll be a meditation teacher and have three daughters, that might have been something which I would have been surprised by. Yeah, I don't think I would have ever have picked it at that age, for sure.
Let's stay on that.
Yeah.
Let's stay a little bit reflective, because when you do look at your life, and maybe there is something from that period as well, what would you say are the three most defining moments that have really shaped who you are today?
Look, if I go back to 10, 11 years ago, learning to meditate, absolutely fundamental. I think it's, that's almost a before and an after, which is what was life before I learned to meditate, which was 11 years ago, and then the after. So consider that one. I don't think you can go past your first child coming into the world, really. I mean, with all of the fear and all of that is just something which you never forget. I remember actually when India was born, that's 17 years ago now, and it was a beautiful day. And I remember, the birth was pretty easy. Heidi and I had a beautiful day together. But I remember after she was born, I went into the bathroom and I just cried. And I don't know what it was. I just sort of fell apart. So I think becoming a father is just becoming a mother, becoming a father, becoming a parent. It's not to say that, but that was such a turning point. And then prior to that, if I'm to sort of really lean into something that I think had a bigger effect on me or thus than I thought was, you know, was it my parents, you know, separating, divorcing? I think that was probably pretty big at the time. I was 17 or 18, I think. So, and look, there are others, but they would be three that sort of jump up when you ask the question. Yeah.
The first one you talked about was life before meditation.
Mm.
Give me a little bit of an insight into what that actually looked like.
So life before meditation was, I had this outwardly good life, an outwardly amazing life. Happily married, two beautiful children. I am running around the world building a business, and Heidi, my wife at the time, is running around building her business. And so between the two of us, it was all a lot of that, a lot of planes and, you know, New York and London. And Heidi at that time, she still is in the fashion business, so we were off at fashion shows. It was all that. It was very glamorous on the outside, and it was a beautiful life. And our daughters, India and Elke, were part of that, and it was fun. It was really good, and we lived at Palm Beach in a beautiful place. So it had all of the those great elements. But I also can point to the undercurrent, and this is, let's go back into my 20s, into my 30s, was also, I loved a party, loved a good time, could do all that sort of stuff. You would probably very rarely have ever seen me drunk, but I was a consistent drinker. I couldn't go to a party if I didn't have a glass of champagne or a beer, because that was my way to get social. Otherwise, before that, I was like, I don't want to go. And 3 hours later, I was didn't want to leave. So in that little sort of 20s into my 30s mix was, you know, a lot of social enjoyment, but it was also with alcohol, drugs, all that sort of thing. And so the accumulation of that was inflammation in my body. I was in constant pain, constant back pain. And at the time, I can see that it was actually also lifestyle because of the way that I lived.
You had quite a successful business too.
Yeah. So I was building that. So like a lot of demands. Heidi was not well as well in her 30s. So put that in the mix. That was a huge part of our life. And so what does that mean? The before and after. Before was kind of probably ignoring or pretending that everything was good. If I was to boil it down, it all looks okay. It'll be fine. We're young. You get away with it. You get away with running that model. Money and a few other things can kind of gloss over a bunch of stuff. You can go on beautiful holidays. So you can kind of get away with it. And then as I headed towards 40, some of the chronic inflammation and the pain and that sort of stuff became very noticeable. And then, of course, flipped that, learned to meditate, kind of turned the light on in the room that you've been walking around in and bumping your knees in the dark for so long. And there was a fair bit of rearranging the furniture once I'd learned to meditate. But the flip side of that, now 10 years in, is a life that is, my perspective's completely changed, but my underlying health and those types of things is better than when I was much, much younger. And there is very, very little pain whatsoever. And the before and after is so black, and the contrast is extraordinary. My relationship with all those things that I essentially needed as props to this whole thing, which was alcohol and those types of things, has evaporated. My relationship with, I think, people more broadly is richer and deeper, because back then I was kind of the person who'd be like, yeah, I've run around the world for now for 20 years. I know everybody. I can't be bothered. I was actually kind of a can't be bothered guy. I was like 60, even though I was 35. I'm being very honest on these podcasts already. But I literally had the attitude, which is like, yeah, you know what, done it all. I was still in my 30s. Now, today, sitting here, and I think I said it to someone yesterday, I was like, I feel like life's just starting and I've just turned 50. So that's in answer to that question, even about what's the day like. Every day to me is just full of just, I know the day will end differently to when it started. Something new will have come up. Maybe I've met someone. Maybe there's something else to consider. But the best thing about the day now, as opposed to then, is that it's just filled with possibility, endless possibilities. And so the reason why I can say that now is because of having learned to meditate. But I can also see how restricted my thinking was then, basically from fear, really, and control. So the flip side of that now, on the other side of it, is that very little fear, in fact, like a complete relinquishing of control, because that's where all the fun is, I think.
There's some really key, brilliant messages in there around how it has transformed your life, and to hear you talking about how you were acting like a 60-year-old when you were 35 is quite extraordinary. But what was the tipping point for you? Because when we're talking about your 15-year-old self, and your 15-year-old self would never have imagined that you'd end up being a Vedic meditation teacher. Mm. What was that turning point when you made the decision to start meditating?
Even though my 30s were all of the things I've explained, there was a part of me that wasn't completely ignoring, you know, the idea of health. So I first went to, I think I met someone, it would have been late 20s, maybe 30s, and someone had said, I went to meet a therapist, this beautiful woman in Sydney, her name's Maya, she still is down at Bondi, I see her a bit still. And I met her, and she basically taught me some guided, you know, I think it was guided meditation, and this was 20 years ago now. And maybe I read The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, and then I would have bounced off all that and gone off and just sort of tried the other way of living, which is forget all that, I'm going to go back to doing research in the unhealthy ways. And then, and interesting, maybe this is the fourth key moment, but I, at about the age of 32, had partial renal failure, and that's not very good when you're 32. And
is that based on lifestyle?
Yeah, so this was it. It was lifestyle. And not to go into the details of it, but I'd basically taken too much anti-inflammatories from pain and hangovers. So I had partial renal failure, and I was told at that point that this was a pretty serious thing, because the next step to that is renal failure and dialysis, and you're not in great shape. And the doctor said to me, he said, you just need to basically eat vegetables and water for the next 6 months. And I also went and did Bikram yoga. And because of my personality, which then was reasonably extreme, was just all or nothing, I went and started Bikram yoga, and I did it for 60 days straight. Every day. I did 60 days straight of Bikram yoga. I had my first experience, or whatever it might have been at that point, of what it means to expand a state of consciousness, and drank water and veggies, and I got into incredible physical shape. And 60 days later, all the tests cleared, done, fine. They were like, look, it's just, don't do it again. Not that it changed behavior completely, but it did change it quite substantially. And it was interesting, actually. I met Heidi just after that, and we were married very, very quickly. We were engaged in 12 weeks, married 12 weeks later. So, you know, once again, some, you know, moving pretty fast of things. And then we had children. But I say that because that was where it started. And even when I was running that model and jumping on aeroplanes, I would still go to somewhere like Gwingana up in Queensland for a week and do all that, and then come back and, you know, run the experiment or learn another type of meditation. So through my 30s, I was pretty consistent on some of those things that I knew were probably pretty good for me, but I wasn't very good at maintaining them because the little bright, shiny object of another party or a trip or something would kind of get in the way. So then I learned Vedic meditation when I was 39, so that's now 11 years ago. So it was just that Vedic meditation came along as another thing for me to try because everything else had sort of been like, yep, I'll give anything a go. But I learned Vedic meditation and I haven't stopped since. So I always kind of knew that there was something else to explore. I just didn't find the thing that I could kind of turn the switch on and then keep the lights on. I'd kind of keep playing around with it a bit, if that makes sense. That's what led me to it. But it took me, 10 years.
So what was it that made it different this time around and you actually stuck with it?
Well, because I think I was trying things that were not really suited to my lifestyle. I mean, you can't do Bikram yoga every day for 60 days unless you're a bit obsessive, because it takes 2 hours. I'd do one in Sydney, fly down to Melbourne for meetings, and if I was going to miss the next day, I'd do one in the afternoon. Like, I was crazy about it, but you can't maintain that, right? I've never done Bikram yoga since, I don't think. But point is, what a lot of us are trying to do is adopting techniques that are not really that suited for us. Now, Vedic meditation is 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon or the evening, and I could get that done because I could get up in the morning, I could meditate. I would find myself sitting outside the girls' school at 2:30 and meditate in the car. I was like, perfect, I could just turn up and meditate there. So the first thing about it was I had a technique that was very practical, and by virtue of the fact that I give things a go, 60 days of this or whatever, I gave this a real go, and of course by that point it wasn't just that I'd also started to see benefits to it. I was going to do it well because that's just how I operate. And then by the time I kind of maybe would have otherwise lost interest in something else because of just wasn't so interesting anymore, I was just doing it. And I was like, oh, this is actually pretty easy to now organize inside my day. And then at that point, I would have maybe found that there are other things going on, like maybe I was sleeping better, or maybe a few other things had started to pop up, and I was like, "Oh, this, I should probably continue with this." So it was different to begin with because of its practicality, and that's where I started with it. I was like, "I can do this 20 minutes twice a day, sure."
And at what point did you start to see those tangible results? Because it sounds to me like you're the type of person that if you don't start to see results fairly quickly, then you would also get bored and move on.
You know, probably within the first couple of months. I mean, my big thing was sleep back then. I wasn't a good sleeper. I'd wake up from 2 to 4. I'd take sleeping pills. I had all of that going on for quite a long time. I remember quite quickly finding that I could sleep pretty well and not have to wake up and take a sleeping pill pretty quickly. Now, I know that because when I was meditating during the day, I was releasing the stress and fatigue and those things from my body. And when it actually came to lying down at night, my body could actually just rest rather than process all of everything else. So I remember it was pretty quick. I remember coming home one night and Heidi had said to me, oh, you realise you haven't had a glass of wine for, I can't remember what it was, maybe it was 3 days or it was a week, it was something. And I just was like, what are you talking about? She goes, you haven't had a glass of wine. And I didn't even know that I hadn't. And just because I used to be on, I'd drive home and do this and you walk in the house and you're like, hey, yep, walk over, click. We're all just like, we can be robots a lot of the time. And that would just be part of my routine to walk in and sort of, maybe have a glass of wine and put my feet up and go, oh, yeah, hey, kids, how are you? And just sort of take a little bit of a moment. But in actual fact, I think because I was meditating, I was going through that process during the day or at least maybe in the afternoon before I got home. And so at one point, that subconscious idea that maybe I need just the idea of a glass of wine just to relax a little bit just sort of went away very naturally. That was another really key one. Absolutely, I couldn't believe it.
So are you a drinker now?
No, not really, no. I mean, when I say no, not really, if someone was to walk up to me at a wedding or a birthday and say, hey, we're going to toast someone for their wedding, I'm not going to turn around and go, no. It's a nice thing to do, right? So you might get a glass of champagne and go, fantastic, cheers too. It just doesn't do much anymore. Because by the way, when I realised that I had my relationship with alcohol changed, I then made very, very conscious effort to stay away from it. So I did at that point, my father died 8 years ago from essentially complications from alcohol. He was a serious alcoholic. And so I kind of at that point knew that I probably should just make a bit of an effort to slow down on it. And for quite some time, maybe for 6 months at least, I wouldn't have even gone to a party. I wouldn't have gone to a lunch because I just didn't want to put myself in that environment. I knew that, of course, my relationship with it was changing, but I also had the capacity to think, well, I don't need to be around it anyway. And then I don't think a drop touched my lips for 8 years maybe. Not because I thought about it, just because I didn't really care for it so much. And then I think at some point, in a way, if you were to go into those environments, it feels a bit rigid to me to say I won't even celebrate something. I'm like, yeah, sure, doesn't matter. So it kind of shifted, it changed a little bit, but it's pretty rare.
How do you explain what Vedic meditation is to a beginner?
I think if we were to consider what it is not to meditate, firstly, you'd say, listen, do you ever feel like you might feel a little bit anxious about something? Or do you wish that you could feel a bit better rested, or that you maybe don't sleep so well? Or are there certain situations where you'd love to think that you could just take a moment and not overreact, because we might be prone to just reacting and getting angry about things? So first we might just say, are there things about your life that you might like to do a little bit differently? And then the second part of that is like, well, if that was the case, then if you could just take a little time out of your day to do that and to ensure that the benefits were quite substantial, is that of interest to you? So you need to make sure that people are interested first. You're never just going to turn around and tell someone to learn to meditate, because any advice offered that's not welcome, well, you're going to get told where to go. So most people will then say, well, I've tried it, it doesn't work, and it's too hard. Now, most of the reason why people are saying that is because a lot of what people are trying in this modern sort of mindfulness meditation movement are techniques that were mostly by tradition and over the course of time, and we can look at thousands of years, are techniques that come from monasteries, and so they're called monastic techniques. A lot of guided meditations, those types of things, come from those sorts of lineages. And what they've decided to do is like, why don't we go and take these ancient techniques and bundle them up and put them into an app or something like that, so that someone can turn around and take 5 minutes a day to become a meditator, rather than maybe doing something that you might do with a bit more discipline. Now, Vedic meditation is not a monastic technique. It doesn't come from that. It comes from a very long lineage, but at what we, like, if we look back up through that lineage of teachers, they were householder teachers, which means that they were engaged in community. They may or may not have had families. And so the technique itself was more applicable to those that did have families, were part of community, did work, let's call it that, for want of a better word. And so when someone at least adopts a technique that is for a household, they'll find that it's far more easy to integrate and to implement, and that we're not trying to clear our mind of thoughts and do all these sorts of things. We're actually just having a very simple, easy technique that we can do anywhere, sitting in a chair, sitting in your car outside school pickup on Bondi Beach in the morning. It doesn't really matter where we do it. So that's the other thing. We don't need to be in a temple. We don't need to be in a monastery. We don't need to be sitting around with our legs crossed and fingers in certain poses and burning incense. It's the complete opposite, in fact. We can be seated anywhere and get it done. And so I think we reframe what it means to meditate with someone who is a bit wary of it or thinks they can't do it, but really would love to maybe adopt something that could take some of the edge off some of these things that we all experience.
It's interesting when you talk about the edge, because there's this constant, not constant need, but I find everybody's busy. I think a lot of us feel like we constantly need to be on the go to be achieving something. Busy does get thrown around a lot in a business sense. It's like, if I don't take that deal, then maybe there's something wrong with me, or, you know, what are my competitors doing? Am I not keeping up? You understand all of that because you've lived that life. But now your approach is quite different and you live life and business in a conscious way. What does that mean?
So before I learned to meditate, right, my idea about building a business was nonstop, be stressed a lot of the time, push, 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 kind of rat up a drain pipe, bend the universe to get things done, okay? And, you know, that's okay, but what price do you pay, what price do you pay later on, okay? You know, there's that saying, sell your soul and buy it back again. Do you know what I mean? It's that model. And I was pretty much on that path for sure. And then when I learned to meditate and moved out of that business, and then I was I was teaching people to meditate. So I did take a step back for probably a year or two. I was just teaching, and then my brother Chris and I were talking about it. He'd learned to meditate as well, and we bought Insight Timer, a meditation app from this guy in California. And at the time, there was 100,000 users. There was 10 teachers on it. It was the first. It's the first app that was ever in the app. The first meditation app ever in the app store. We're talking 2009 or 10. I mean, the thing's been around for a long time. And we thought, let's fix this up. But what we knew at that point was that we could do this differently. And from the day one, we thought, let's not, for instance, in that space, you might try and advertise. But we're like, no, we're going to do this consciously, which is like, let's just let word of mouth build. And now, by the way, we were pretty sure we could do this, but we also had a few things come our way which actually showed us that it was possible, which is you could build something consciously. In that Bo Hsiao, who's our chairman now, he's well known in the States as a venture capitalist and he's a fantastic guy. Bo contacted me on LinkedIn just out of the blue. He said, oh, you know, let's chat. You don't know who I am. He said, my wife uses Insight Timer. I think I've got an idea about where you're going with this. And when we started talking to him, and he came along and became a shareholder. And so we were never really out there. I don't think we put a deck together for the first 3 or 4 years. I just don't think we had to, because once again, Insight Timer was this entity that was just attracting what it needed. And it wasn't actually so much that Christian and I were doing anything. You just had people meditating, and people that meditate will understand that it's a more of a laws of attraction thing than a laws of chasing and pushing and force. It's power versus force in that space. So all of a sudden this community was growing. 100,000 turns into 200,000 and everyone's meditating, and it's like, well, in actual fact, if we just sit back and let Insight Timer do its thing, it will attract the resources that it needs. And it just did. And it has continued to do for now, 7 years since we essentially became custodians. Even saying co-founder, we don't like, we bought it from someone else. We've always felt we were just custodians of this thing. And so that approach to, let's call it a business, and we've never even called it a business, I don't think, that approach to an entity like that requires quite a bit of hands-off. And it's that ultimate thing. It's, you know, you bring a child into the world, and how much can you just let that child go into the world, birth something, love it, support it, and then go, okay, off you go, step back. And we've had to do that a bit with Insight Timer on numerous occasions because of there are other big players in the space. Headspace, Calm, their model was different. They raised a lot of money. It was advertising by customers. We've never bought one user, not one. And we're at 22 million registered users or something. Yeah,
that's it. I mean, you are the world's biggest online meditation community. And yeah. So what you've done and the approach you've done has made a lot of sense. I think, though, a lot of people listening to you speak might actually be going, yeah, well, that sounds easy for him, but I wouldn't even know how to get started. Like, come on, I'm not just going to be hands-off and everything's going to happen.
Yeah.
So what's your advice for them?
Learn to meditate, firstly.
With you?
Well, yeah, sure, with anybody. And I don't say that. And that's not a flippant response. Mm-hmm. The only reason my brother and I can actually sit there when things are getting like, I mean, the good version is 100,000 users, bought it, whatever, now it's 22 million, and between it has just been this, you know, this perfect ride. Absolutely not at all. There's been everything that comes with it, with all of the those moments and the this and all the, you know, all the stuff that comes with building anything, okay? And it's not the first time I've done it. My brother and I have done it, you know, time and time again. So there's no question that the fact that we were reasonably old to have done it. I mean, I was 44 and he was 42 when we actually bought it. So we were, but there was a fair few scars on our back. Like, we knew not what to do. And as brothers, we also could just second guess. So we could turn around and get things done really quickly and not even have to ask each other. I was living in Paris. Christopher was living in Bali at the time. We bought the whole thing on Slack. But what I'm trying to say is that when I say learn to meditate, it's that to what extent, when things are challenging, can you actually keep perspective and objectivity around what's going on? Because often enough, if we're in that place where we're losing perspective, we might overreact to certain situations. We won't wait and hold and just see what's going on. There's a saying, we keep the camera rolling, right?
Is that your saying?
It's just a broad saying. It's definitely not mine. Other people have said it. But you know the person who can turn around, who's sitting there and they're filming something and they realise that it's a tornado or something's going on, and most people will drop the camera and run away. It's the person who can turn around and go, no, if I keep filming, I'm going to capture the shot of the year, okay? To what extent can we, in anything, but let's talk about in business for now, keep the camera rolling, because something's going on here. And the more that we can sit there and just observe and hold and not get all caught up in too much of the drama of it and stay unoverwhelmed, then mostly we'll be able to turn around and just see what happens. Let's see, let's see. I say let's see all the time. And Christopher and I said it a lot building Insight Timer, and we can still say the same things, let's see, because there's a real tendency to rush. Only fools rush in, right? It's the old saying. And basically try and stop anyone from rushing in. It's not that they're fools. They just kind of don't know what else to do, right? And so we applied that. Now, the reason why we could have, though, is that we were and continue to be, certainly that time, we were very dedicated meditators, and we went to India a couple of times. So we were cultivating a way, an approach to business that was definitely different. But I think we're in pretty good, you know, like we're in a pretty good place now. And people had approached us to say, well, you guys should just pour, you know, just throw money at advertising, buy users, buy customers. Easy to maybe turn around and think about that, because you're talking about pretty big numbers. But we didn't do it.
Now, my regular listeners know that I'd like to talk about personal branding and PR on this show. And I know that it's quite a new journey for you working with us at the PR Hub. And it's not unusual for people when they start working with us to feel really uncomfortable and out of their comfort zone talking about personal brand and putting themselves out there. Because people that start businesses, that's not front of mind when they do it. The idea of being in the media.
Yes.
Tell me how like, what are your thoughts now, having worked with us for a couple months? What are your thoughts about personal brand and leveraging that to grow a business?
So where I come from as a meditator, it's that we ultimately could, Viktor Frankl said something like, you know, you don't need to leave your desk. You just need to sit there, be quiet and still. The world will have no choice but to lap in ecstasy at your feet. Right, which is basically don't do a thing and everything turns up for you, right? A wise person once said or did nothing. So if you think about the underlying idea of meditation, which is that you just meditate and you de-excite things to the point where, of course, whatever is required will be there for you, okay? So the flip side is this, we start talking about personal brand and this and PR. It's pushing, fundamentally. It's like, here's a story and I'm going to get it out there because I want to get your attention in a very busy, busy, cluttered place, whether it's meditation or business or tech, doesn't matter. It's like you're competing for people's attention. So for me, the idea that I would, and for 11 years, 10 years now, I've had a one-page website. I have done essentially nothing on Instagram. I have a LinkedIn account now, thanks to you guys, with 27 followers. 27.
So it's still early days.
It's early days. So it is the absolute opposite to what I have ever done. Now, the flip side of that, though, is that I also could feel myself being very rigidly opposed to it. So when I find myself being rigidly opposed to something, I think, well, in actual fact, it's uncomfortable to go there. And a big part of any of these ideas, and as we get into meditation, is like, well, where is the discomfort? Because that's where you've got to move. Because in actual fact, if you're uncomfortable, that's where things are starting to change and shift. If you're staying back in, oh, everything's fine mode, then there's not much change going on. So when it was put to me that maybe it was time to do that, and I'm now a decade in, and this idea that in actual fact, by me kind of getting out of my little, I don't want to do this way, and being a bit rigid about it, and actually maybe trying to share a bit about what it is that I do, that ultimately people would be interested in learning to meditate, which I know is, for me, is what I decided to spend all the time that I have outside of being a parent and a few other things, is that if people can have an experience where they get to just take a little bit of pressure off and maybe sleep a little bit better and feel a bit better and feel a bit more creative and productive and happy, then, well, it makes a whole lot of things better, both in their lives, their families' lives, communities' lives, and fundamentally that's what – it feels like that's what we need to try and do if we're to deliver to a need of the time at the moment, which feels like – we're all at each other's throats. There's so much division. It's all going on. So when I thought, okay, let's step into this and understand what a personal brand looks like, I haven't even worked out whether I have one yet, but I thought, well, maybe it's time to do that and get a bit uncomfortable, learn quite a lot, which I'm doing with you guys, and see where that goes. And so far I can see that there is benefit to that, because fundamentally everyone has a story. How much are you prepared to tell that story openly? How much are you prepared to feel a bit vulnerable about it? How much are you prepared to expose a lot of the stuff that maybe you weren't very proud of? And that's where I have to step into the space around alcohol and things like that. I don't really particularly want to even be reminded of all that sort of stuff. But I know that when I learned to meditate, I had a conversation with the person that taught me, who immediately spelled the idea that the fact that I, you know, loved to drink or loved a late night was was okay. Just come and learn to meditate. Instead of getting serotonin and endorphins from alcohol and drugs, why don't you get them from the fact that your brain produces them when you meditate? And I went, oh. And he goes, it's just a better way to do it, and you don't wake up with a hangover. So in answer to your question, what does it mean? I'm slowly but surely hoping to be more comfortable with the idea, because we all, as we do things and build businesses and get to that point in our life where we know that we're doing the right thing, or at least we're on the right path, that other people want to be somewhat given permission to do the same thing. And if other people turn around and go, you know what, I'm going to go for it, I'll do this, or I'll get uncomfortable for a moment, then that's where basically things start to happen.
It's a great perspective though. And most people, as I said earlier, most people who sit in the chair where you are and have a chat with me never feel comfortable about that idea of, oh, I'm building a personal brand, or, you know, I'm engaging in public relations or putting myself out there. But as you said, if people hear about what you're doing and how it can change their life and you can help change some lives, then that is a great reason to be doing it. And you mentioned LinkedIn earlier from years ago, where you actually got contacted on LinkedIn, and that led to opportunity.
It did, exactly right.
At Insight Timer. Exactly so, right. You know, that's a great example of why you might be on LinkedIn.
No, and now that's a really good example. And I actually said exactly that to someone a couple of days ago about the same thing. They go, oh, you're active on LinkedIn. I was like, oh, yeah.
That's
I told
me.
Them the same thing. I said, in actual fact, you know, being there a long time ago was a major step. So what we're kind of basically saying is that, and there's a bit of a saying, but it's like, what preference am I going to surrender? And because most of you think about it, it's like, okay, what a preference. And most of that preference is based on the fact that I can't be bothered, I'm too tired, I don't want to stick my neck up, I'm nervous. Ugh, that's what it is. My preference is not to. If we think about and actually look at preferences and go, well, in actual fact, I'm saying no because of all my stuff, so I'm going to let that go, I'm going to surrender that and move. We can surrender the preferences around everything. It's like, I just want to sit around and eat pizza all night. No, surrender the preference. Go and have fun or whatever it is. Don't eat pizza, eat salad. I'm just saying that. So most of us can ask the question, what preferences am I surrendering? And if we start surrendering preferences with quite a bit of an awareness, you'll actually find that a lot of things start to change. People write about this, David Hawkins, letting go. It's the same thing. Get out of that bit which is uncomfortable, surrender it, let it go, and then move. And, of course, we get great rewards.
I love that piece of advice.
Let's see.
It's going to be fun. Now, before we get into the last segment, I want to talk about what you do for fun.
What I do for fun? I can be enjoying myself with very simple things. Do you know what I mean? I don't feel like I need to make fun out of nothing. But I ride a motorbike, which I love.
Which
was in the photo shoot today.
I've heard you've ridden from Sydney to Melbourne.
Yeah, I ride. Well, it's a race, like it's a race bike. So riding from Sydney to Melbourne is not what everyone would do. But I did that couple months ago for the MotoGP, and I'm a bit of a rev head. I like my cars, and I also have learnt to fly in the last couple of years, so I find that stuff enjoyable. So yeah, that's fun. I mean, I find most of life pretty enjoyable, but they're the things that sort of give me a few kicks for sure.
When you say learn to fly, what does that mean?
Just fixed wing out at the airport. You're not going very fast in those. They're actually pretty slow. So I've been doing that, and it's been really good. I really love it. I love it. It's fantastic.
All right, we've hit the last segment, 5 in 5. First question, do you take holidays? Why and where do you go?
The holiday's a funny thing. I used to think that a holiday was where you'd go to sort of turn up and it was all beautiful and you'd probably sleep for 3 days and then recover from the last 6 months, and then next thing you know, you're back at the office. So since I learned to meditate, my holidays have taken on a different thing. They're a bit more adventurous. Like, I'll go to India and no one would think that's a holiday. Of course, it's the best thing I could ever do. Next year, I'm taking a bunch of people up to Arnhem Land for a week, and we'll be exhausted by the time we get back. But it's adventure. So
what are you doing there?
We will be right up in Arnhem Land, off the grid. I went up with a group a couple of years ago. We can now go back up because COVID. Essentially, it's a meditation retreat, yeah. But we'll just be doing some good stuff and fishing and all sorts of good things. Beautiful part of the world. No phone access. So my point is, what's a holiday? I think that, to me, I don't need to go away and sit on a beach. It actually doesn't really do very much for me whatsoever. I can appreciate beauty and those types of things, but I don't feel I need a holiday. You know why? 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night, I'm literally taking a holiday twice a day because it's the exact same process. Go away for a week and you go through that Neville's cycle of stress release, fatigue release, maybe get a cold, maybe recover and maybe feel great and then you're back home. Whereas that little thing happens twice a day. Regular meditators will say the same thing. It's like, I don't really I need to break from anything. I'm just engaged. If I happen to go somewhere because it's beautiful with my family, I'll do that. But holidays have changed. Holidays aren't the same anymore. People are on their phones, on their laptops, even though they're on holiday. Can't escape. What's the answer to that question? I don't feel I need them. But I'll go and do something challenging or adventurous whenever it sort of arises to do so.
It's a fascinating response because in the close to 50-odd interviews I've done, I think you're the first person that said that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't know. Right now I'm not thinking like, when am I? I went up to Bali with my daughter for 4 days a couple of months ago because it was the end of the school holidays and I think her mum and sister away and I said, we just ran up to Bali for 4 days and 4 days sitting by the, I was like, yep, okay. Does that make sense?
Done
I don't,
now.
I just don't. And I couldn't even tell you next year. I can literally say next year I have no plans to take a break.
All right, question number two. If you weren't on this journey or this path and you could do anything else, what would it be?
I hurt my back when I was, like I broke my back essentially when I was 17 years old and it really knocked my confidence around sport, skiing, surf, everything. And there is nothing else I could ever imagine. I can't imagine doing anything better. I can't imagine living a better life. But it would be the complete, it would be the idea that if I wasn't doing this and I'd always wondered it would just be to be an a really, really good surfer, skier, like kind of adrenaline junkie. That would be it. Because I kind of always sat there, I've sat there for the last 30 years and gone, you know, bugger, I kind of had to take a step back. And I think about it a lot.
Question number three, what's the best piece of career advice you've ever received?
Do the deal. I'll never forget it. My first boss, I was in Hong Kong, I was 25, and he just kept saying, do the deal, do the deal. And I think fundamentally he just said, whenever it's there to be done, do it. And I remember I worked for him. He sort of mentored me for quite a few years. And it was just this idea that when there's something to be done, do it. And don't, you know, we'll negotiate a little bit, but I've just always thought about it. And in actual fact, he was really saying, be very spontaneous about opportunities that come up. Be very spontaneous about getting things done. And I still say it to this day. I still just, if I'm talking to someone and whatever, I'll just like, just do the deal, you know. And I think we can overthink it sometimes. And it's kind of saying, okay, you might leave a bit on the table, just get it done. Get it done every time.
Question number four, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
That I harbour thoughts to be a extreme sportsman. That would be it. And probably that I'm a bit of a rev head, really. I've mentioned that before, that I love being on a racetrack on my motorbike. I love those things. I don't think people would think about that so much. And I think probably what happened was is that the fact that I couldn't do things physically meant that I replaced it with machines in a way. I've always thought that. Even 10 or 15 years ago, I was really got into track stuff with my car and that sort of thing. And I can kind of almost see that I got the adrenaline kick out of being able to do it in a machine as opposed to the fact I couldn't. I'd sort of end up with limitations physically.
All right, last question. Question number five. This podcast is all about influence. So what is your number one tip for people with influence?
Just be authentic about how you wish to talk to people, I think, and not make it up. You know, there's no need to embellish your story. There's no need to say more than is necessary, and then own the tough stuff, because that's what people are looking for. They want to be able to relate to the harder things, not necessarily the bright, shiny light stuff. And I think it's all too easy to say someone did this and someone did that. And people think, well, is that attainable for me? As opposed to saying, that did happen, but let me tell you about this. And this was what happened on. And maybe it is getting into some of the things that are a bit more relational. And I mean that by we could be relationship with health and all sorts of things. But I just wonder whether do you necessarily influence by virtue of pushing the six, you know, the good things that have happened as opposed to maybe being open about, you know, the tougher times. And I think people know that, but that would be it. I think there's a responsibility to be, people are going to be naturally authentic. You don't make that stuff up, but there's a responsibility to, I think, just you know, kind of tell it as it is.
It's a great one to end the show with. Have you got more than a one-page website these days?
Not yet, but apparently it's in development.
You know why I'm asking? Because there's going to be plenty of people listening to this podcast that want to connect with you and want to find out more about what you do. And I reckon you've convinced most people that they need to check out Vedic meditation. So where can they find you?
Look, best thing is my website is nicoplowman.com and literally just says contact, and you can send me an email and either myself or someone will get back to you. And that's what I do. I do think, though, within a month there will be a far more sophisticated website and be all sorts of things on there. But that's it.
And you're on LinkedIn now too.
And I'm on LinkedIn now. Instagram, not so much. But LinkedIn, you'll find me for sure.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Nat. It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we wrap the show, we will pop Nico's details into the show notes. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast through your favourite app. Give it a rating and leave a quick review so that we can reach more people like you who want to unlock their influence. And if you have a question for me, you can email me at samantha@theprhub.com.au. Until next time, thanks for listening. Take care.
The Influence Unlocked podcast was presented by Samantha Dyback, CEO and founder of The PR Hub, and executive producer Andrew Menzel from Piccolo Podcasts. Want to connect with Samantha? The links to her LinkedIn and Instagram accounts are in the show notes.